在一起待，想起
We gather in reverence before the wonder of life, the wonder of this moment, the wonder of being together so close yet so apart, each hidden in our own secret chamber, each listening, each trying to speak, yet none fully understanding, none fully understood. We gather in reverence before all intangible things that eyes see not, nor ears can detect, that hands can never touch, that space cannot hold, and time cannot measure. Good morning, and welcome everyone. Whether you're here in front of me, or watching at home, or maybe even listening to the podcast later on, My name is Ayla Nikanvui, and I'm 18 years old, and I have been coming to this church since I was a baby. This is my first time doing a service, however, so do forgive me if I'm a little nervous, despite the many familiar faces. The name and theme of my service this morning is Genesis, but there will be no references of any sort to Phil Collins. This is an open pulpit, a tradition of this church, but I would like to make it clear that the views expressed are entirely my own and not a reflection on the Unitarian Church. The service today should, hopefully, propose a thoughtful view on the idea of creation and how that can help us with the environment. So with that in mind, let me take a moment to say a few words and light our chalice. Flame of fire, spark of the universe, that warmed our ancestral hearth. Agent of life and death, symbol of truth and freedom, we strive to understand ourselves and our earthly home. Just to note that despite the restrictions easing, I think that congregational singing isn't coming back until next week. But if you can't be kept from singing, I think that it's not illegal for you to sing along, maybe under your breath if you know the words. So do that if you must. This prayer that I'm going to say now is a Native American teaching that caught my eye because of the name. The sacred hoop. This is the theory that the reality of the world is made up of rings, or hoops, which I thought sat nicely with the theme today. Then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all, and round beneath me was the whole ring of the world. And while I stood there, I saw more than I can tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing in the sacred manner, the shape of all things of the spirit, and the shapes as they must live together like one being, And I saw that the sacred ring of my people was one of many hoops that make one circle, wide as daylight and starlight. And in the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father. And I saw that it was holy. Although we can't say it together, I don't think, I would like to gather us in community through the words that Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Our reader this morning is Sheila. Mm-hmm.
Morning, everybody. I chose my reading before I knew the theme of the service, so it seems very serendipitous that I've chosen a poem called Begin by Brendan Kennelly. Begin. Begin again to the summoning birds, to the sight of the light at the window. Begin to the roar of morning traffic all along Pembroke Road. Every beginning is a promise, born in light and dying in dark, determination and exaltation of springtime, flowering the way to work. Begin to the pageant of queuing girls, the arrogant loneliness of swans in the canal, bridges linking the past and future, old friends passing, though with us still. Begin to the loneliness that cannot end, since it perhaps is what makes us begin. Begin to wonder at unknown faces, at crying birds in the sudden rain, at branches stark in the willing sunlight, at seagulls foraging for bread, at couples sharing a sunny secret, alone together while making good. Though we live in a world that dreams of ending, that always seems about to give in, something that will not acknowledge conclusion insists that we forever begin.
My dad, Dennis Conway, is going to take the children's story this morning.
Good morning. So this is a children's version of the book of Genesis. In the beginning, there was no earth or sky or sea or animals. And then God spoke in the darkness, "Let there be light." And right away there was light, scattering the darkness and showing the infinite space. "That's good," said God. "From now on, when it's dark, it will be night, and when it's light, it will be day. The evening came, and the night passed, and then the light returned, and that was the first day. On the second day, God made the earth, and over it God carefully hung a vast blue sky. God stood back and admired his creation. "That's good too," said God, and the second day was over. The next morning, God looked around and thought, "The earth needs to be a bit more organized." So God put all the water in one place and all the dry land in another. When God had finished, he made plants to cover the land. Dandelions and daffodils appeared. All sorts of trees and grasses began to grow. "It's looking great," said God. And that was the end of the third day. On the fourth day, God looked around and thought, "The daylight still needs a bit more work, and the night is just too dark." So God made the sun to light the sky during the day, and the moon and stars to add a bit of sparkle to the night. God hung them in the sky and stepped back to look at his work. "This is coming along very well," said God. The next day, God turned his attention to the water God had collected in the oceans. "I want these waters teeming with life." As soon as God said it, it was so. In no time, there were millions of small fish darting through the shallow water and huge fish swimming in the ocean. God made birds too. God sent them soaring through the air. "Ah, this is good," said God. The dusk fell over the water and the sky grew dark, and that was the end of the fifth day. On the sixth day, God added creatures to the land. God made lions and tigers and bears. God made rabbits, sheep, and cows. God added everything from ants to zebras to the land. But God still felt something was wrong. So God added humankind to enjoy and take care of all that God had created. God looked around and was happy with all God had made. After 6 days, the whole universe was completed. And on the seventh day, God had a nice long rest and enjoyed looking at all the beauty that had been created.
My reading this morning is a series of extracts from an essay called From Transcendence to Obsolescence by a literary ecologist, Harold Fromm. It's an overall assessment of how nature goes quickly from being a source of hardship and transcendence to being silent and passive within the human psyche. What I'd like to get across from this reading is that the generation or generations before mine are not to blame for all the aspects of climate change. There's this myth that global warming started in the 70s, and everyone in the Western world has been working to increase its damage as much as possible before they were single-handedly stopped by Greta Thunberg. But the main source of change within our society's view of the environment is where we place ourselves within it. And those ideas have been developing for centuries. So what I'm saying is the inevitability of climate change was inevitable before anyone in this room was born. So Harold Fromm, From Transcendence to Obsolescence. In the course of human history until the 20th century, there was never any serious likelihood that humans could win the body-mind battle on the field of the body. If you found that it was necessary to produce 10 children in order to ensure the survival of 5, if you lost your teeth by 30, carted your own excrements out to fields, or emptied chamber pots out the window, you could hardly come to believe that your ideal self would ever stand forth on the field of the body in the natural world. Nature was indeed the enemy. Good sense taught that it was pointless to waste what little life you did have in quarrel with the cruelty of nature, when the rational solution could only have been to accept a final rest in the kindness of God. If we are indeed made in the image of God, then it was reasonable to assume that only God could fully appreciate the human unconquerable mind, while a just assessment of reality shows that the body must be given up to nature. So saints, martyrs, prophets, priests, and nuns came to embody the spirit and the soul. The approximation to spiritual perfection, however difficult, was a more realistic goal than that of bodily self-sufficiency or domination over nature. Fascination with the fall of great heroes and mythical figures, Achilles, Oedipus, Faust, is a form of painful recognition that nothing physical can endure, not only in the obvious sense of death, but that everything created can barely stay alive. For most people, the fear of human fragility and a lack of substantial power against the material world made profound self-confidence a luxury only for kings. For others, realism required an acceptance of the divine will. Existence was a gift, and the creature had no rights. All was grace. But then the Industrial Revolution came. So the decline in religion from the 18th century onwards cannot be seen as accidental. As the average person is saved from the relentless harassment of the elements by the grand mediator of technology and modern science, their perception of nature undergoes a startling alteration. No longer does nature seem quite so red in tooth and claw. And so their need for transcendence melts away. If this connection is real, it also insinuates that humans of the past were not a jot more spiritualized than we are now. It was not that the human sensitivity to ideas of the good and the idea of the beautiful were any more developed in past history. Rather, it was the human need to escape from an intolerable physical life that is infinitely more oppressive than ours. But while this newfound mental assurance allows the human to believe themselves the ruler of all creation, so much so they no longer even rely on the comfort of God to guide them, a new trouble rears its ugly head. Our nurturing environment threatens to stop nurturing and start killing. So begins a new chapter in the heroic fall of humankind. We continue our Faustian legacy by refusing to see humans as compiled of anything other than mind, no longer defined by our bodies. But this new era comes with opportunity. We have shown that we can control elements of nature, to an extent. We have learned that transcendence relies on nature, but that it need not be as a result of fear. Humans are the only living beings on the planet that have the ability to live in harmony with all other living things. We are a new Oedipus. The age-old struggle between the individual will and the universe has been replaced with the necessities of modern life and the environment. In other words, a retelling of classical tragedy in which we have total control over its end. That is from Transcendence to Obsolescence by Harold Fromm. Now I will read a short extract from a poem by William Wordsworth, which will be followed by a moment of silent prayer and a musical interlude from Josh and Gavin. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things.
Oh, beauty of the earth.
In September of 2021, I started my first year of English and philosophy at university. One of my first modules was an introduction to the philosophy of religion. After 2 weeks of online lectures, I had a tutorial in the module, and in order to prove my eagerness, I volunteered to make a presentation on the existence of God with two others. We'll call them Kieran and Johnny. By coincidence, I had met Kieran before, but neither of us knew Johnny. He has a fiery red-headed mullet and a strong northern accent. The first thing he said to us was, "You're in luck. You'll be making this presentation with a believer." We went to get coffees together, and it became very clear that Johnny is not just any believer. He is a self-described, hardline, loyalist Protestant who belongs to the Free Presbyterian Church, the Church of Ian Paisley, to be exact, and who idolizes Edward Carson. Surprisingly, though, it was another aspect of his beliefs that struck me most. He's a creationist, believing that the earth began 6,000 years ago, according to the book of Genesis. I have nothing but respect for other people's beliefs, as has been instilled in me by this church, but it did pose a problem when we had to make a secular presentation on the existence of God together. About a week later, my professor in that module referred to creationism and the Irish philosopher Usher, who managed to pinpoint the exact date of the first day according to the Bible. Usher believed that the world was made on October 22nd in 4004 BC. During this lecture, I was sitting in the Usher library in college, watching the leaves turn, which to me was a series of uncanny coincidences that I just couldn't ignore. The beginning of the universe has significance in science and religion, as both parties argue that it points to there being, or not being, a God. The very fact that there is a universe at all has always been a point of deep reflection and contemplation. As English philosopher J.J. C. Smart said, "My mind often seems to reel under the immense significance this question has for me. That anything exists at all does seem to me a matter for the deepest awe." Using the universe's beginning as proof of God is known as a cosmological argument, coming from the Greek words cosmos and logia, directly translated as discourse of the world. I won't endeavor to fully discuss cosmological arguments, but I will boil down their premises to this. One thing happens after another. One thing moves after it is moved by another. One thing comes into being after it is created by another. But these create a problem. Where did it all begin? Therefore, there must be a prime mover, a first cause, a necessary being, God. While studying this, I spent a lot of time cycling in the Phoenix Park, and I began to notice a major flaw in all of these arguments. The philosophers we studied say that infinities are impossible because nothing could ever begin, but they use that argument to prove the existence of a God that is infinitely good and just and powerful. I looked at the park around me and I thought, what if they're all circles? Why can't each cause cause another simultaneously? Since that moment, I've noticed that many philosophers and thinkers in general lack a basic understanding of the way that the earth works and how it influences us. I call this understanding my environmental lens, and it has helped me in ways I couldn't have ever imagined. The fact is that with this lens, concepts of infinity, goodness, justice, and power don't seem so difficult. Through this environmental lens, we not only gain a clearer picture of the earth, but also the divine. This realization sent me on a journey to look for further sources to back my beliefs, being fully aware that I wasn't the first person to think this. One day, I bought a book called There Is No Point of No Return and was introduced to Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss's idea of the ecological self for the very first time. Simply put, it develops on theories of the self to expand it beyond human horizons. One of the earliest concepts of the self, as Harold Fromm mentions in the reading, is in the second chapter of Genesis, when God makes Adam and Eve in God's image. The mistake I think that we've made is thinking that being in God's image makes us singular and distinct from nature. You don't have to believe in God to fall victim to this idea. Deep within society remains the idea that humans are extraneous to nature. However, even in a secular way, the transcendence of nature can help us to understand and encounter the sublime. Arne Naess describes a form of introspection that allows us to include the earth and everything on it in our idea of the self. Christians often note that looking inwards is a way to understand God. So to me, the obvious answer is that these two ideas are not oppositional, but complementary. It makes more sense that being in God's image is inherently to be a part of the earth. To paraphrase Arne Naess, the meaning of life and the joy we experience in living is enhanced through increased self-realization, which implies a broadening and deepening of the self to include the world at large. If you're anything like me, you'll probably be confused by such a vague idea and what my father describes as a ridiculous Tibetan bowls idea. To be honest, initially it was Naess's attitudes around love that actually caught my attention. Naess believes that when we love ourselves, it broadens our sense of self to include other people. We can be aware that to love others properly, you must love yourself first. But achieving that is much harder than it sounds. It is so important that we understand that the root of community is the extension of love, and according to Naess, the extension of ourselves. We, as a church, hold a doctrine of love, showing that we already have a fundamental understanding of its importance in service and worship. There's this false idea that to be a good environmentalist, you have to be a more morally mature person. Perhaps this is because we have been led to believe that a selfless love must be a self-sacrificing love. Jesus was a martyr. We must give up meat for the planet. We cannot make funny jokes because they're not politically correct. We are incapable of seeing this supposed sacrifice as a part of love and not as a byproduct of it. We assume we must suffer, but that will only ever lead to bitterness. Let's not forget that sustainability, by definition, is about preservation and longevity. The right decisions will be an extension of love, not a diminishing of the self. This brings me back to the ecological self. It may be easy to understand how other people can become integral to your sense of self, but how could a tree or a badger? But not only that, but how could every tree and every badger and every person? Well, I counterpoint this by asking about your childhood home or your favorite spot in the city or the country. How do you feel when the flower you planted grows again in the springtime? Or when you wake up to a beautiful sunrise and a fresh cup of tea? Do you feel a sense of something you can't hold? Maybe it's not that you find nature beautiful from a distance, but you actually find yourself in nature, which makes it beautiful. The Greek philosopher Plato proposed that the physical world we lived in paled in comparison to the world of forms, where the ideal representations of all things lived. Our souls belong to the world of forms and return there after our bodies decay. Many have heard of this, especially because of Plato's allegory of the cave. But what fewer people might realize is that Plato, through the dialogues of Socrates on his deathbed, used this idea for a theory of reincarnation. In Phaedo, Socrates states that our souls return to the world of forms only to be reborn into a new body. Our awareness of the existence of the forms is a vague recollection of this experience. Most beautifully, Socrates tells his companions that if they look around them, they'd notice that everything in the world moves in circles. So why should life and death be any different? When asked why he reserved such a startling revelation for a moment so close to his death, Socrates replies, "Though they do sing during their lifetime as well, swans reserve their longest and most beautiful song for when they realize it's time for them to die. Mankind's own fear of death causes them to say it's a song of grief and lament the swans are singing on their departure. They ignore the fact that no bird sings when it's hungry or cold or in any other kind of pain. They sing because they foresee the good things which await them, and they are happier that day than they have ever been before." Socrates' consolation in his belief in reincarnation allows memory to become the key to unlocking the reality of the world, much as Ness believes introspection to be the gateway to expanding ourselves. One of my favorite figures in classical Greek mythology is the goddess of memory, Mnemosyne. She is the daughter of heaven and earth and the mother of the nine muses. This, I think, is particularly apt of the Greeks. Because what is memory if not the tool of love and creation? Think back to what that childhood home and sunrise have in common. They not only fill you with joy at their beauty, but wonder at what they remind you of. We constitute our love for things by remembering them. Similarly, when we interact with nature, we instill a memory of ourselves within it. So if you remove that interaction, if you isolate yourself from that reality, you lose that part of yourself. It's possible our souls do not belong to the ideal, but our bodies do belong to the earth. Even if our reincarnation is only into fertile soil, we are still a part of the unified community we have built. We have the power to make and remake new worlds all the time, but that does not make us gods. It makes us human. This is all very important, but it lacks an element of practicality necessary for climate action. The number one question people ask concerning climate change is, what can I do as an individual to help? It can seem daunting, and let's face it, a bit useless. As comedian Sean Locke once said, tackling climate change on an individual level is like showing up to the aftermath of an earthquake with a dustpan and brush. And yet, I suggest an answer. You draw three overlapping circles in a Venn diagram and title them What I Love, What I'm Good At, and How I Want to Help. Where these three circles overlap, that is what you do. One of the biggest problems in climate action is that so far, it has asked everyone to do the same things. The better thing would be to take advantage of our individual strengths and skills collectively. But the far more important question is not what you should do, but what we as a congregation should. What do we love? What are we good at? How do we want to help? At my first proper introduction to this church, Bill Darlison poured a cup of water over my head and handed me the world. You, as a congregation, promised to help raise me, and you have. But I'm giving the world back and asking you what we should do with it. If the world began 6,000 or 4 billion years ago, it doesn't really matter, because life as we know it could end. And for what? Those were the thoughts rolling around my brain as I sat in the Phoenix Park at the end of October, mulling the world over and off my shoulders. And I thought that love is too small a word to describe how I feel about the park. It is now a part of my heart. Each branch on each tree not only mirrors each other, but my veins and lungs. To understand me, you'd have to understand the park. On that average October day, I realized that I was only one tiny manifestation of the earth. And I loved myself. And so I loved the world. After all this study, I have found that I held common ground with Johnny the Unionist. I have come to experience that the world was made on a crisp October morning and ends when love is lost. Amen.
Our notices. Well, first of all, I have to say thank you, Ayla, for the lovely service. I do remember your baptism in the church, and I know you were on the back of Oscult magazine at your pictures of your baptism. I also remember Sunday Club one time, and Bill Darlison is at the front of the thing with a group of children, and he's telling them a version of the story of the hare and the tortoise, and Bill says, and who do you think might have won the race? And a very precocious Ayla said, I think if you read to the end of the story, Bill, you'll find it was the tortoise. She's fulfilled her promise. Thank you, Ayla, and well done. I think you're probably the youngest person to take a service here by a few decades, probably. So I think a round of applause. Really, really appropriate. Thank you too for our music and our singing this morning. It was lovely as well. There's no offertory, but there is a box on the way out if people would like to make a donation, and it's possible to make a donation online. At 7:30 this evening via Zoom, there's a meeting of the Singleton Trust. Wednesday lunchtime reflection service is available online via the webcam or in person in the church. It begins at about 1:05 till 1:35. I'm absolutely really, really happy today because there's so many signs of normality here. The book club meet on Wednesday via Zoom, 7 o'clock. This month's book was Our Little Cruelties. Thursday at 7:30, our discussion group meet via Zoom. We are talking about an essay called Unitarian Christianity by William Ellery Channing. Discussion group sounds very sort of philosophical. It's not. We read it, we chat about what we've read and give our feedback. Another sign of returning normality, the walking club meet next Saturday for a walk in Devil's Den. They meet at 11 o'clock for 11:30 start at the, what's the name of the cafe? The Hog Cafe in Ashford. That's, and these are on our notices that are sent around. It's a loop walk and it's about 5 kilometres. February we are designating as Refugee Month. This church has been very active in supporting refugees. We have a family we are looking after. We can do more. We need to replenish the coffers of the Refugee Committee, and that will be next month. We're going to put envelopes out. You can bring one home, pop it back in. There's details on the back of the magazine if you want to make a donation directly into their bank account. But it's part of the important work of this church, reaching out to support other people who are a heck of a lot worse off than we are. Ayla, do you have a blessing?
Yes. Before I do the benediction and the blessing, I would just like to say my own thank yous. Thank you to Bridget, of course, for giving me this opportunity. And thank you to everyone for helping me realise it. So Josh, Gavin, Kevin, Dad, Mom, Paul. Paul, particularly for encouraging me to write in the Uskult and for doing the flowers and the welcoming. And thank you to everyone in the congregation for making me feel comfortable enough to get on this pulpit and say what I had to say. With that in mind, we'll close with a benediction. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Amen.